great pleasure to me to celebrate Audrey Richards. I was Jack Goody's student and I restudied the people studied by Maya Fortes, but Audrey Richards was my favourite Cambridge anthropologist. And even though our first encounter was a bit embarrassing in the end for me, I wrote a very highfalutin essay for her, and she rejected it completely and kept pestering me with detailed empirical questions, and then finally told me to go home and write it again. I was outraged, of course, and so I wrote the most pedestrian thing I could possibly imagine and read it out to her in supervision. At the end of it, she said, "All right, Mr. Hart, we've now established that you can walk. Perhaps we can discuss your aspiration to fly." she was full of bon mot. She was a really, really idiosyncratic old bird, I have to say. she gave me a jam thermometer for my wedding present, saying that all marriages need a little sweetness somewhere. She had these bon mots like, if you find something you like, buy four of them. And her final, we had a birthday party for her 80th birthday party, and she produced this knock 'em dead speech in which she said, "Well, it's very interesting being 80. All you have to do is stand up, sit down, and people say, isn't all too wonderful? At 80, you're always wonderful." I don't think it's true, but it was for her. I became director of the African Studies Centre, as Harry said, in the 90s. And when I was asked, I said, "I'm not an Africanist, you know, because I wasn't." When I went through the Cambridge Anthropology Department, it was basically stitched up by Jack and Maya with their Ghanaiologists on one hand and Edmund Leach and his South Asianists on the other. And I just didn't want to spend the rest of my life at seminars where people spoke mostly in particular names that you were assumed to know because you were a specialist in a particular area. So I kind of escaped to a development studies outfit in East Anglia. And ever since, I tried to extend my range. But the time that I spent in West Africa under the supervision of Jack and Audrey and Maya have been the formative influence of my life. And I think, I'll never fully understand what I learned then. But what I'm going to talk to you about today is, in some sense, where I've come with the questions that were posed when I was a kid, 22 years old, living in a slum in Accra. And when I came into African studies, I said, first of all, I don't like the idea of Africa being made an object of study, something that we kind of intellectuals sitting here can study as an area, a thing of its own nature, some kind of natural object. And I said, to me, what matters is Africa's place in world history, and especially its evolving relationship with us, with the Western world. And to some extent, I was given a remit to pursue that. I have to say that in the late 80s, I spent 3 years with the Caribbean revolutionary C.L.R. James, a Trinidadian writer and historian, and basically full-time revolutionary all his life. And that changed my attitude to certain things, but it meant that I wanted to make sense of my experiences of the Caribbean and America in relation to Africa, and not simply focus on Africa as an area of study. And as part of this, with Salah Banda, a Sudanese associate, I started studying the history of Africans at Cambridge. And we came across some very interesting people, like George Bridgetower, who was a mulatto violinist, who was a sidekick of Beethoven's, for whom he wrote the Chrysler Sonata, and then fell out with him over a girl, and dedicated it to Chrysler, who couldn't even play it. And George Bridgetower was sent down for playing African drums behind Great St. Mary's on a Sunday morning, and later became the director of George IV's orchestra. So these were some, and then another one was Alexander Cromwell, who was a black Baptist preacher from the United States, who conceived of the project of former slaves resettling Liberia, and in fact invented the word Pan-Africanism, and he was a student here. But the thing that was most surprising to me, I think it would be to you, given all the myths that we have about Cambridge and its isolation, its separation from real life, its division between town and gown, was that Cambridge was the center, the fulcrum of the abolition movement in Britain around 1800, before and after. And this movement was driven by none other than William Pitt, who was the MP for Cambridge and the Prime Minister at the age of 23. But he couldn't support it fully or openly, because he was the head of the Tory party, who were against abolition. But he set up Wilberforce and indirectly a number of others. And it turns out that, and of course, Thomas Clarkson, who was at St. John's, became the main leader of the movement on the ground in Britain. And there were an extraordinary collection of people. There was George Peckard, who had been dean of the Peterborough Cathedral, and had dedicated his life to making life easier for Gypsies, Jews, and Methodists, and who was Vice Chancellor of the University and made the most revolutionary speech since the Reformation in that little church behind the Market Square, and made a speech called "Am I Not a Man and a Brother," which launched Clarkson in his career. There were some amazing people involved. I mean, nonconformist preachers, Tory high churchmen, Master of Queens. There was the most radical magazine in Britain at the time was called the Cambridge Intelligencer, and it was run by a man called Benjamin Flower, who advocated abolition by means of revolution. And this was in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, in 1803. So this was an extraordinary ferment, and it transformed itself over the years into a very strong commitment at Cambridge in the 19th century to train and send out evangelical missionaries. We've got feedback, okay? So I became involved in looking at it. There's a very fine book by a Trinity historian called Boyd Hilton called The Age of atonement, and it's about the relationship between religious, political, and economic thought from the 1780s to the 1850s. And it seemed to me, studying this whole business in which Cambridge was such a powerful driver, that, I knew this meant about an hour setting this thing up. I knew it wouldn't work. what he pointed out was that there was a kind of ideological synthesis in Britain among certain classes in the first half of the 19th century, in which free trade and economic individualism were pursued equally with the anti-slavery movement and with a kind of salvationist Christianity linked to Methodism. And this, I think, was a sort of ideological revolution in Britain, and it's one that has not received the attention that it deserves. So all of this is a kind of preamble to my reason for talking tonight about Africa in the 21st century and the prospects for revolution there. I would like to shift, my scope in this lecture, for which I have probably about 35 minutes left, is three centuries. The three centuries since the birth of industrial capitalism in the around 1800. And it's about a sequence of forms that I consider to be definitive of the emergence of a world society in our time. And in this world society was created in the 19th century by a European expansion supported by the machine revolution and by demographic growth of quite striking proportions. By the end of the 19th century, people of European descent control four-fifths of the inhabited land surface of the planet. And so this sets up for them, in the course of this land grab, a definite question: how did we do it? They assumed that they must have been able to do it because they were smarter than the others, and before long this became attached to a biological definition of the causes of being smart or retarded. But it's important to know that in 1900, Africans, which Africa has something like 14% of the land area of the planet, and it had then 7.5% of the people. So it was the least population, the least densely populated, the least urbanized major inhabited area of the world. And it represented fairly easy pickings for an expansionist European civilization driven by machine industry and finance and a number of other goals. So now, at that time, in 1900, Europeans and people of European descent accounted for 36% of the world population. People living in Europe alone accounted for 25% of the world population in 1900. Today, it's a lot less than that. And by the end of this century, Europeans will account for 6% of the world's population. So that in 200 years, Europe will have moved from being a dominant people in the world, controlling most of the world's land, to a parochial region with a fast diminishing population. The Africans, on the other hand, in the last century have increased their share of the world population to something like their share of the land area. It's now about 15 or 16%. But it's, what's more important is that Africa is the only region in the world whose population is still growing. And it's growing quite fast on a scale similar to the European population between 1830 and 1930. It's still growing at about 2.5% per annum. And UN forecasts suggest that by the end of this century, Africa will account for almost 40% of the world's population. Asia at the moment accounts for 60%, and Africa 15%, so it's 4-1. But at the end of this century, Africa and Asia will account for 80% of the world population between them, and will have populations of roughly equal size, because the Asians are aging also. Now this is a demographic transformation of the world, extraordinary size and significance, and it's one that is barely noticed in the North Atlantic societies, who still cling to an imperial vision of what Africa was and perhaps still is. But the Asian manufacturers have recognized for some decades now that Africa is bound to be the main focus of growth in the world market in the coming century. And this is just on the basis of bodies. It was even more so given that Africa in the last two decades has been growing economically, although unevenly and in disputed ways given the forms of measurement. Africa is growing significantly economically at this time. You probably know it's that 7 out of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world are now African. The other 3 are China, India, and Vietnam. So this is the context for my work at the moment. My question is, if Africa is going to become quite strikingly, is going to adopt a new demographic at least relationship with the rest of the world. I mean, just imagine that the whole of the new world, Europe, Russia, Australasia, and Oceania, will account in 2100 for 20% of the world's population. And in 1900, the Europeans in Europe alone accounted for 25%. So this is, and it is the case, where those of you who are not economists, which of course I'm not, but I pretend to be, population is a very important indicator of the size of an economy. You would be, look at a country like Bangladesh, you probably think of as being backward and poor, but it's a big country in terms of population, and its economy is one of the world's largest. So my question really is, what political conditions might allow Africans to translate this growing economic and demographic preponderance into a more equal say in the councils of world trade and related matters? What would it take for Africans to achieve a degree of practical equality on the basis of this momentous change? And that's the subject of my talk today. Now let me talk about Africa. I would just like to say that traditionally Africa has been identified as being 3 regions. North Africa was always part of the Bronze Age urban revolution beginning in Mesopotamia. Southern Africa in the 20th century came to be conceived of as being distinctive from the rest of Africa as a result of its particular form of settler industrialization. And the rest was usually called Black Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa or East, Central and West Africa. Now, what I'm trying to get hold of is what happened to the world after Western imperialism began this coercive process of bringing people into an industrializing commercial entity. And I would argue that the most important event of the 20th century was the anti-colonial revolution. It was people seeking to establish their own independent relationship to that world society, having been brought into it in this coercive and unequal way in the previous century. And this anti-colonial revolution was much aided by World War, of course. This is the framework for my attempt to explain what has been going on in Africa in this century. I mean, in the previous 20th century, I mean, most of the time when people talk about Africa, they say it didn't develop in the 20th century. But what is it that really happened in Africa in that century, both under the colonial regimes of the first half of the century and the post-colonial regimes of the second half? And obviously, one of the things that happened, although it isn't anything like as large and fast as the demographic development going on now, was that Africa had a population and urban explosion in the 20th century. Now, Jack Goody, my teacher and mentor, spent a lot of time trying to explain why institutions in sub-Saharan Africa were different from those typical of Eurasian civilizations. And he decided that the principal reason was the low population density in Africa, which meant that land as property never acquired the significance that it did in Europe and Asia, and the class divisions based on conserving property differences were not ever as developed there. So clearly, to summarize a very broad-ranging argument brutally, what I believe happened in Africa in the 20th century is that Africa joined the urban revolution of agrarian civilization that had dominated Europe and Asia since 5,000 years ago, but in doing it, it did it therefore by, I mean, states were established, colonial and post-colonial states. They were increasingly urban in their composition. The elites that that occupied them drew their surpluses from intensification of agriculture more than anything else. And in the process, the differences between the three main regions of north, southern, and the middle, as it were, have decreased. That is to say, North Africa is still stuck in the agrarian civilization, pre-industrial phase. Southern Africa is on the way down, you might say, if there is any way down from apartheid. But there is a real set. I mean, deindustrialization has certainly set out in South Africa. It's been replaced by Chinese imports, but the economies that are growing very fast are mostly in this middle range: Ethiopia, Ghana, Nigeria, Tanzania. And so my argument is that what has been established in Africa in the 20th century, even though the rhetoric has been of something like national capitalism, development or whatever, is the old regime of ancient civilization, of agrarian civilization, that the African societies have been converged to a large extent on a single dominant political economy, whereas in the 20th century they were, and before, they were quite radically different. Okay, so that is the premise for one of my arguments about what might be done now, which is what is the antidote of the old regime, the antidote of the old regime, pre-industrial, predatory political elites, is a liberal revolution. A liberal revolution is essentially animated by three ideas: markets, democracy, and science, and is based more than anything on freeing up movement of people who are being held down on the ground, as it were, by coercive and restrictive political institutions. I'm going to have to take this off. So this led me to examine the... I've spent quite a bit of time in recent years looking at the classical liberal revolutions of the Western world, the American, the French and the Italian, but also at the German, which nobody would describe as a liberal revolution, but which did have very strong liberal components. And I've been living in France for 17 years, and I've become very interested in a particular event in the history of the revolution. I mean, 1793 was the year of the terror, when the Jacobins unleashed their machine against the Girondins from Bordeaux and regions like it. And 1793 was the last novel of Victor Hugo, and it's about the War of La Vendée in Brittany. In 1793, one of the things, by the way, you know, that I've learned from this work is we tend to identify revolutions with particular dates, like 1776 and 1798, but these people were involved in war for decades. It wasn't something that happened overnight. And in Brittany, a Breton royal and Catholic army, supported from the sea by the British, launched an attack on the Republic, which of course was broke. But the city of Nantes, which was the biggest port at the mouth of the Loire and the main slave trader and Caribbean commercial agent in France, the city of Nantes held out against the other Breton and was besieged. The siege of Nantes, all French historians have since seen as the hinge of the revolution, whether it was going to succeed or not. And it was really violent. I mean, they drowned 4,000 presumed Catholics in the Loire while they were under siege. This is known in France, ironically, as the National Bathtub. But it was a very brutal and awful war. I mean, it's very well described by Hugo, with atrocities on both sides, but mainly on the Republican side. And the siege was, and it is the case that the non-bourgeoisie paid for the Republican army, because armies need money, as you probably know. and revolutionaries don't often have much of it. This is part of the overall scenario, that if you're going to have a revolution, you need some people with big bucks to back you up. So anyway, the siege was relieved, and my question was, why would this backward slaveholding commercial bourgeoisie of the Atlantic coast support the revolution? What's the revolution? What's in it for them? And the answer was that they were held back by impositions at every level of transport. I mean, if you wanted to move goods or money or people inland, and they did because they were importing stuff, you were stopped every few miles, and you had to pay through the teeth to some feudal landowner or some other bandit, or the kind of people who hold you up in rural Africa, you know, the police, in other words. I mean, what the Republic was offering was a national market with reduced tariffs and impositions and taxes and fees paid on the movement of trade goods within the country. And this is not unlike the Italian case. I mean, you know, the Italian, Garibaldi was financed by the industrialists of Milan and Torino. And what they wanted was to escape from Austrian protectionism. They wanted access to the world market unhindered by Austria, and they wanted the parcelated sovereignty of Italy to be collapsed into a national entity that would allow for the free movement of goods and people and money. And the more I've looked into these cases, the American case, I mean, the American Revolution was financed by American and Dutch tea smugglers. Because George imposed a monopoly for the East India Company on the Americas, which they thought was the last straw. That and being forced to pay for British foreign wars. The German case is particularly interesting because it's the forerunner of what happened in Europe since the Second World War. The Prussians formed a customs union in 1818. It was a very small affair, three or four small Hohenzollern dependencies, but within 50 years, this customs union had grown to be the basis of political unification of Germany. And in the course of this, they developed the most articulate vision of an expanded regional national economy in the form of the German economist Friedrich List, who starts out by saying that the Germans face a fate of being mere drawers of water and hewers of wood for the British economy. And if we want to get out of that, we have to create a national economy which brings these politically fragmented entities together and allows for the freedom of movement of goods and people and harmonization of tariffs and the rest of it. But, and this is the most important point, this freedom of movement at the regional or national level has to go along with protection from world trade. This is something that, because of four decades of indoctrination, people find it very hard to imagine that you can be a free trader who believes in protection. Because we live in an era where the very idea of protection anywhere in the world economy is frowned upon. But if you look at it, you'll see that the Americans developed this way, the Southeast Asians developed in similar ways. The recipe was actually first developed by Sir James Stuart, a Jacobite exile economist, wrote Principles of Political Economy in 1767, 9 years before Adam Smith's book. Adam Smith was professor of political economy at Glasgow. The word political economy didn't exist in English before Sir James Stuart, and Adam Smith never mentioned it in his book. I mean, that's, you know, the losers get wiped out, I suppose, in this kind of thing. So the key concept here is that a country seeking to, or an area or region seeking to develop from behind has first of all to consolidate politically the conditions of its own internal market, and then protect producers in agriculture, industry and services from unlimited competition with more developed international powers. Is this vision that I've taken from the German case and from the Italian and the American and the French? In all these cases, even though France appears to have been a monarchy and a centralized society, it was in fact at the time extremely fragmented and decentralized. And just to bring this into some kind of contemporary relevance. A Chinese car costs $5,000 to make in China and transport by sea to Tanzania. The same car costs an extra $4,000 to get to Kampala. Okay? Now, I mean, this is, in other words, what we know about the contemporary conditions in Africa is that there is an awful lot going on that is making it difficult for people to move and retain the value of the objects that they're carrying with them, not to mention their money. And this is for many, many reasons, but principally because 54 nation states in Africa are, I mean, there is almost no it's very hard for African governments to raise taxes internally. They depend very heavily on raising taxes of import-exports at the borders. But it's not just that. I mean, there are rent seekers, as it were, preying on travelers at every stage. And I mean, one of the questions, I mean, I'm absolutely sure that China, in its long-run vision for Africa, knowing as it must how central African markets are going to be, I mean, has a definite interest in reducing the cost of internal transport in Africa. What it doesn't have as an interest is the Africans turning around and protecting these markets from them. So that's one possible source of conflict. So with this in mind, I've studied regional trade integration. And I mentioned in the publicity for this lecture, you know, my own original research on informal economy in Ghana. I am outraged by the fact that the vast majority of Africans are routinely criminalized by just trying to move around the continent in ways that they've been free to do so for centuries. And this only because they are the principal source of revenue for a parasitic political elite that claims it's managing the national economy. So what I've been looking at are the prospects for regional integration of trading regimes. And of course there have been when Thabo Mbeki pursued his African Renaissance project, the immediate question was Well, maybe we can use the AU or NEPAD, it's Johannesburg branch. And he talks about, you know, the need for a single currency, need for a central bank, the idea that the political elites would converge on Addis Ababa and kind of write a, sign a piece of paper saying we now have a, you know, an African trade pact or whatever. But if you look at these other examples, especially the German example, I mean, this isn't how it really happens. It doesn't happen by heads of government signing pieces of paper. It happens when different interests come and clash and form alliances in a piecemeal way over long periods. I've looked at SADC, the Southern African Development Community, and I've looked at ECOWAS, which is the strongest alternative in Africa, but there are some even more interesting developments taking place in East Africa at the moment, some of them motivated by the mobile phone phenomenon there. And it's quite clear that, these regional trade associations serve the opposite purpose of trying to help people move around. I mean, the there are extraordinary proliferation of special tariffs and impositions. It's better in West Africa than Southern Africa. And of course, for me, the principal cause of all this is the continuing dominance of nationalism as the ruling ideology of African regimes. I mean, if imperialism formed world society in the 19th century, then in the 20th century, nationalism had its time. And if I were to say what we're walking into at this stage, despite the obvious impending collapse of the European Union, which was once celebrated as the leading example of the phenomenon, they made a mistake with the money, that's all. But it's a lot. I mean, the Americans centralized their currency after a civil war. The Europeans centralized their currency as a means of achieving political union without doing anything else. But nevertheless, I do believe that the trend for some decades now has been towards regional trade federation as a growing economic model. Of course, some of the largest countries like China, India, Russia, Brazil, the United States are already federal regional entities of different kind. But the formation of ASEAN in Asia, of Mercosur in Latin America, NAFTA, the European Union, RIP. Sorry, I'm not here to persuade you to vote for Farage. I am a Europhile. I've been living in Paris for 17 years, goddammit. It's just, you know, I wish they would get to grips with the problem. Instead of letting the Germans try and keep their banks solvent by knocking everybody else. Anyway, what was I talking about? I believe that it's inevitable. I think we are moving in this 21st century to, I mean, the world that the Europeans made was highly unequal, divergent, and unipolar. The world that is emerging now is multipolar, obviously, and there is to some extent a measure of convergence taking place to redress some of the inequalities that were typical of the high imperialist phase of European world domination. So it seems to me that regional association of one sort or another ought to be a practical model. But what I insist on is that if Africa is to make its way in the world with more weight than hitherto in the coming century, it will have to be on the basis of establishing its ability to regulate incoming money and goods. I don't know how or why or that might occur, but I know that it will be messy. And I believe we are entering a period in which the dominant underlying tendencies in conflict in Africa will be between the old regime, supported by the traditional imperialist powers who depend on their fragmentation and dependency, growing attempts to liberalize the movements of people, money and goods within Africa itself. Now, and if that was so, it would not just be a liberal revolution for Africa or many piecemeal liberal revolutions, but it would constitute at some level the end of the racist world society that we've been living with for several hundred years. Because if Africans are no longer despised as weak and inferior and easily manipulated and invaded and suborned, then we will be living in a very different world. And it's a world that I went out as a graduate student to study. I mean, in the 1960s, we believed that we were living in decadent societies. We believed that our polities were crap, and that we looked to the newly emergent former colonies and their military heroes, Fidel Castro, Ho Chi Minh. I mean, these are the people whose names we chanted, Che Guevara, Kwame Nkrumah. I went out there thinking that I was going to learn from the recently decolonized Ghana some ideas about how to change our societies. You know, I mean, that was the point. And of course, I was a bit disappointed when I got there. I mean, I went out there to study politics, and when I got there, I found it was a police state, and nobody wanted to talk about politics, least of all to me. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? You know. So I noticed there were people boosting everything from marijuana to refrigerators in the street economy. I thought, that looks dynamic enough, I'll study that. But it's still the case, you know, that I retain these dreams of childhood, if you like, that Africa, in its development and movement and energy and hope, you know, may show the rest of us the way. And that's certainly what I'm in it for now. I've given you a very elliptical sketch, but I'm afraid we'll have to do for now.